This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I feel very protective of the mothers who do make those choices and very, very sort of defensive on behalf of every single stay-at-home mum who's ever had somebody instantly lose interest in them at a party when she says what she does all day. You know, and this happens a lot. Every stay-at-home mum knows what it feels like when somebody says, so what do you do? And you say, oh, I'm a mum. And you can already see them looking over your shoulder.
And now, The Good Fight with Yasha Monk.
Today, I am starting the podcast with two slightly different announcements. The first is that Persuasion has partnered with the Civil Discourse Initiative at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, to bring a set of interesting speakers to MIT, some of whom we will feature in conversation on The Good Fight. The first of those is Mary Harrington, an interesting feminist philosopher with whom I debated in an interesting, if sometimes somewhat contentious way, about how much progress we have really made towards equality between men and women on today's podcast episode. You will be hearing more about this conversation and the initiative at MIT from Alex Byrne and Brett Skoe, who lead it. The other initiative is that we have a fun event planned for any of our listeners who happen to be in the United Kingdom. On January 22nd, we would love for you to join Persuasion and the Equiano Project for a conversation on the usefulness and the limits of the American cultural frame in places like the UK. It'll feature great panelists, including Tomiwa Owolade, James Bloodworth, Sonia Soda, and it'll be moderated by Inaya Folarin Imam at the Sackford in London. I hope you enjoy this week's conversation.
My name's Alex Byrne. I'm a professor in MIT's Department of Linguistics and Philosophy.
And my name's Brad Skoe, also a professor in the same department. And the two of us have started a two-year project at MIT called Civil Discourse in the Classroom and Beyond. Since Yasha's interview on this episode follows up on one of our events, we wanted to say a bit about the project by way of introduction.
Universities have a dual mission, the discovery of truths and the instruction of students. A core means to the first of these is academic freedom. Faculty should be allowed to pursue and debate ideas as they see fit. But the second part of the mission is no less important. Students should be able to have productive, good faith conversations with others with whom they disagree. And this has a civic as well as an intellectual justification. Exchanging ideas with opponents is part of being a good citizen in a democracy. The goal of our project is to help MIT students gain this essential skill.
The project is generously funded by the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations and has two core components, a speaker series open to the MIT community and seminars in Concourse. Concourse is a learning community inside MIT for first-year students, and two faculty from Concourse are on our team. And in their seminars, the Concourse students discuss freedom of expression and develop skills for successfully engaging in civil discourse.
Our goals align closely with Persuasion's, so a partnership between the two was a natural choice. British writer and reactionary feminist Mary Harrington visited us at MIT to discuss the question, has feminism made progress, with Anne McCants, a history professor here at MIT and one of our team members.
The room was packed, and Mary and Anne modeled how to discuss controversial issues in a civil manner. We hope the students got as much out of it as we did. And now, more Mary talking with Yasha Monk on The Good Fight.
Mary Harrington, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you're known in an interesting sense as a critic of some of the forms of feminism that have been dominant in the last decades. I take it that those traditional metrics you're talking about are questions like, do women have the vote? Are they participating in the workplace? How much income are they able to generate? Why is it that those are the wrong questions? Not the wrong questions, but insufficient questions to ask.
So the logic of second wave feminism emanates from, as I explained a little while ago, a specific tech transition, which was into what I call the cyborg era, which is to say that the contraceptive era. And I think that's, we can argue the toss about that, and I'm sure we will at some point. But I think this is wildly underpriced as a transformative shift in the entirety of culture, because it just completely rewrote interpersonal relations at an absolutely fundamental level on so many different axes, and had a huge number of downstream consequences, you know, commercially, legally, politically, economically. I mean, it's integral to women's access to the workplace on more or less the same terms as men. There's a huge raft of social changes and equality legislation and cultural transformations which are downstream of all of that. Most of that is good. Now, to be crystal clear, when I say I don't believe in progress, I don't take from that that things are necessarily getting worse. Now, all my argument ever really is that when you for any given gain that you make, there are probably some trade-offs somewhere, and that sometimes those trade-offs land asymmetrically, and often they're obscured by a simplistic narrative of directional moral improvement. So when I talk about the contraceptive era, to be clear, there are a great many benefits of those, and you know, I am a beneficiary of a great many of those improvements. I'm a graduate woman. There are opportunities which are open to me downstream of all of those social transformations, which wouldn't have been if I'd been born in 1920, or would have been at, you know, considerably greater personal risk and cost. And it would have been considerably more challenging to do actually most of the things I've done with my life since I left school. So I'm not saying that all of these things are bad, but the logic of the contraceptive era has also been to present women with an understanding of ourselves and our embodiment and of what it means to pursue the good, which is constitutively at odds with our biology, which is to say we're offered a version of emancipation, which means we end up waging war on our own bodies, you know, as a precondition for being able to pursue that form of emancipation. And the logic of that has been broadly beneficial for several generations of women, but it's now, you know, following through its own logic, arrived at a point where it's reversing into net negative gains, in my view, for at least some women. Which is to say we find ourselves waging war in a sort of culture of broad-based body dissociation.
I'd love to hear more about that. So again, I think it's obvious some of the freedoms that the pill and the broader sexual revolution and social changes that brought about has given women. Tell me a little bit more about the ways in which it's negatively impacted women in your estimation.
Returning again to the logic of trade-offs, one of my heuristics for thinking about technology more generally, not just the contraceptive pill, but technologies more generally, what it tends to do is free us from some limit that previously seemed a given. I mean, we could take transport, actually, which you were talking about earlier. I mean, motorized transport freed us from what had previously seemed the limits on how fast you could travel. I mean, I just flew 5,000 miles around the world to come and speak at MIT, and thank you very much for having me. And this is not something which would have been possible 200 years ago. You know, on its own terms, that's progress. And one of the trade-offs that tends to come with escaping previous limitations, Ivan Illich is very strong on this. I don't know if you've read his critique of the car, is that escaping a previously given limit will end up making us dependent in other ways. This is Ivan Illich's theory of counterproductivity. In a sense, we become dependent on the technologies which we imagine have freed us. So now, like, there are a great many people who might be freed to travel, but there are now people who don't have the opportunity not to travel. Or there are people who can't afford not to have a car and therefore spend, as this is Ivan Illich's argument, spend half of their working week earning the money to pay for the car that they need to get to work or to maintain the car. So the whole thing becomes a kind of cycle of a different kind of dependency. And what tends to happen is that you liberate yourself from what was previously a set of embodied or physical or givens governed by social codes. And what happens is that the market moves into that space. So this is my heuristic for thinking about technology more generally. And one of the ways I've set out to understand what happened with the contraceptive revolution is to think of it as the point where we turned our liberating technologies in upon ourselves, particularly women. And what that's tended to do is to deliver a huge dividend of freedom. I mean, my freedom to fly 5,000 miles around the world and come to amazing, exciting speaking opportunities at MIT. But what also happens is that the market moves into our bodies with it. So as well as, for example, opening up sexual freedom, immediately downstream of the contraceptive pill, you get a libertarian defense of the porn industry, and you get a mushrooming of the sex industry, and you get your whole new types of commodification of female sexuality, which existed previously, but which were now impossible to to sanction it at a social level, simply because the material reason for forbidding them was just no longer so pressing, because the concrete risk of pregnancy was so greatly reduced. So it's very much harder to argue in that situation that women shouldn't sell sexual access to themselves, because, I mean, at the end of the day, who does it concern except you? I own my own body. And if body autonomy is liberating for most women, then surely also by extension, it's liberating to those women who want to sell sexual access. And my argument, my critique of this is not to say women shouldn't be allowed. This is not even beneficial to some women who want to sell sexual access. It's to say whether or not that's beneficial depends on how much social status you have. If you look at the sort of happy prostitute archetype, which comes up a lot in advocacy for the sex industry, what you tend to see is that these are middle-class women who've chosen this lifestyle. And what you very, very much less frequently see is the trafficked women who were impoverished, who came from the global south, who were children when they were trafficked, who were drug addicts or who needed to make rent or whatever, and who are also liberated into being able to sell sex, but were not in fact in a position to choose to do so and were instead coerced into it. So what I'm saying is the liberation that comes with technologizing our own bodies also comes with a dividend of commodification, and the benefits of that accrue asymmetrically depending on how much social status you have in the wider context. My critique, it's a fairly straightforward piece of class analysis that says this is emancipatory except for the people who are just having an absolutely terrible time under this metric, under this order. And once you extend that into the human body, it begins with contraception and the boom in the sex industry. But subsequent to that, you get the industrialization of fertility, which is also downstream of the same logic of control and commodification of women's fertility. And now it's possible to sell your eggs and to pay your college tuition. And sure, there are some women who've graduated from university debt-free as a consequence of doing that. There are other women who've been more or less bullied into doing it, or who've done it out of economic desperation and then found themselves significantly harmed or traumatized or even left infertile by it. Once you get into the granular detail of the logic of commodifying women's bodies, a great deal of which is downstream of the contraceptive revolution, you begin to see that it's a very ambiguous picture as to whether or not it really is in women's interests in total. You know, if you want to define it narrowly as the greater emancipation of bourgeois white women with high social status, I would say yes, absolutely, that group has been net beneficiaries of the industrialization of women's bodies. But I would argue that there are a great many costs in the commodification of women's bodies outside that demographic.
So that's a really interesting set of arguments. Let me try and puzzle through this argument from commodification. And I'm going to try and channel, I'm perhaps not a very convincing or appropriate spokesperson of it, I'm going to try and channel second wave feminism here to imagine what they might respond. I mean, the first thing to say, I suppose, would be that the second wave feminist reading of marriage in traditional societies, as I understand it, is that it was all about commodification, right? That marriage was a kind of property contract in which the husband acquired property over women. Even when you go back to something like John Stuart Mill, his objection to the laws extant in England at the time of him writing The Subjection of Women is that whether he wanted to or not, in fact, the man acquired a kind of form of property over a woman in the act of marriage. And so at that point, women were effectively the property either of their fathers or of their husbands throughout life, unless perhaps they became widows, at which point they had some form of agency under certain circumstances. So when we're thinking about whether that whole set of social changes you're talking about has commodified women, I guess the first thing I would say is, well, for the vast majority of them, it's given them more agency because they are now able to have a job and command a market wage, and the laws about marriage have changed. And as a result, they have a whole lot more agency. And then when it comes to the question of sex work, I guess I would just note that that seems like a choice we've made since the 1960s. It's not the case that the introduction of a baby pill has automatically led to the legalization of all of those forms of sex work, as is evident from the fact that different societies, all of whom have a pill, and all of them have a pill available to women, have adopted very, very different laws about sex work and pornography. Some extremely permissive, like in the United States, some a lot more restrictive. And so on that count, I take your argument that perhaps those very permissive laws may ultimately be bad, or may at least come with very serious trade-offs, so we should take more seriously than some feminists do. But it doesn't seem to me that that follows necessarily downstream from those changes. There are choices that different societies have made, and different societies have chosen differently, even in the presence of something like the pill and other modern contraceptive technologies.
So just to reiterate, the argument that I've made in Feminism Against Progress is speaking about the Anglosphere. I'm comfortable with my analysis being applicable to the Anglosphere. And, you know, while you may be right that there are other cultural contexts which have responded differently, I've explicitly set those aside in making the analysis I have. Just on the point of marriage and commodification, yes and no. You're right that one of the some strands of second wave feminism are sharply critical of marriage and see it. It's often read through the lens more or less the one that Engels sets out in. I think it's the origins of the family. I think it's called. It's a 19th century book on where he views women's subordination as originating with agriculture, and he calls it the world historical defeat of the female sex. I'm not gonna try and argue back against Engels, but just to say, if you only go back to, say, the 18th or even the 17th century, you're possibly not going back. Well, certainly if you go back to the 18th century, which would have been what John Stuart Mill, the context that John Stuart Mill was writing in, he's responding to his sort of immediate cultural past and women's predicament under those circumstances. And really what he's responding to there is the conditions of early industrialization, which the women's movement also responded to. And he's right to make the critiques that he makes. Because under the conditions of the early industrial era and the legacy social and cultural institution, the institutional environment in which the inherited from the pre-modern order within which marriage was understood was no longer a good fit for the material conditions which were brought into being by industrialization. So just to unpack that a little bit, the fundamental change which industrialization brought to family life and the central one that the women's movement responded to was in draining work from the home. And what happened at that point, prior to the industrialization, prior to the arrival really of modernity, and both sexes worked. Now, this is not to say that it was all sunshine and roses. I'm sure there are plenty of grim homesteads where nobody really liked one another and work was dull and arduous and grim. But one thing we can say with a great deal of confidence is that both sexes worked. Work was gendered. When men's work and women's work were clearly distinctive. I mean, again, in the book I've drawn from Ivan Illich, who writes in a great deal of anthropological detail about the genderedness of men's work and women's work in agrarian societies. And under those circumstances, the kind of work that women did was generally conducted with children underfoot. And again, it made, you know, I'm sure there were plenty of trade-offs to that situation. I'm sure there were, you know, plenty of toddlers who died by falling into a fire because all of their parents were busy working or whatever. But this is how it was. And under those circumstances, women had a measure of economic agency under the terms that made sense at the time. But the key thing to remember is that the principal economic unit in the medieval world was not the individual as it is under modernity. It was the household. Under those circumstances, legal personhood wasn't really separable in any meaningful sense because it just didn't make sense to think of people as individual economic producers or consumers in the way we do today. I mean, it's difficult to grok from a modern perspective, but it was a fundamentally different thought world and a fundamentally different political system. And under those circumstances, I mean, most people didn't vote full stop. Hardly anybody had the vote full stop. But what then happened as we arrived in Britain in the 18th century into the industrial era was that it was women's work that left the home first. Textile making, for example, and butter, you know, the processing of foodstuffs into consumables for the family. You know, those sorts of small scale ingredient processing and productive work for the household. It was no longer women's work within the home. With children underfoot, as it had been since time immemorial, it then became much more something which happened outside the home with women as actually relative to their pre-modern forebears, significantly disempowered chief consumer in a private household. And I mean, we can sort of slice this even more depending on where you are in the social scale. But this was a totally new situation for women to respond to. And one of the big challenges that women faced under those circumstances was that where previously they'd been considered as part of the household as a productive unit, suddenly they no longer had equal as a measure of economic clout, but the legacy fancy legal system that they'd inherited from the pre-modern world still considered the principal unit to be the household. And so they basically had no leverage whatsoever. Now, this is fine if your husband loves you and he's a good provider and he, et cetera. And so, you know, if you're lucky and you've married a good guy, this is fine and you can probably make this work. And there's a whole raft of women's writing in the 19th century, principally, which concerns it makes a positive case for bourgeois domesticity under those terms, you know, on the assumption that what you have is a good husband and a good provider. There's also a huge efflorescence of reformist women's campaigning, which seeks to remedy drunkenness and domestic abuse and tries to do something about all the men who are not good husbands. And then there's a whole other efflorescence of women's activism, which is concerned with remedying women's specific vulnerabilities under the legacy legal and cultural system. For example, in addressing coverture and calling for the vote. For example, in seeking to give women the right to work so that if they did find themselves in circumstances where they were left destitute or they had a neglectful or an abusive husband, you know, they could earn a crop. And so that women could own property in their own right, so that women had a claim to their children. So all of these things are really responses to a transformation in the world, which had been driven by very much larger socioeconomic changes, and which it was right and proper for women to respond to on those terms. So, but we're just bringing it back to the question of marriage. If you only look back to the 19th century and the predicament that women were under in the 18th and the 19th century with the beginning of industrialization, you're not looking back far enough. And I would question the automatic assumption that marriage in the medieval world was so straightforwardly hierarchical and proprietarian and patriarchal as all of that. I would want to see considerably more detailed historical analysis before I made a claim like that confidently. And I think if we're simply reverse engineering everything in the context of the specific dilemmas of the 18th and 19th century and early industrialization, we're not doing our history thoroughly enough.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
If we're chronicling some of the trade-offs of the changes that have been brought about for the last 50 or 60 years, one of the obvious ones seems to be the juggling between workplaces, child-rearing responsibilities, and so on, right? So the positive cast on this is the, you know, you can have it all kind of attitude that women now are able to have very fulfilling careers and have children and loving families at the same time. The negative cast in it is that they're pulled into all these different directions, that it's impossible to do all at the same time, and that if they fail to do one of those things, then they're seen as somehow incomplete because they choose not to be mothers or because they are housewives and don't participate in the workplace and so on. What is your view of this area of contemporary reality for women?
I'd be hesitant to speak for any other woman or any other mother in any sort of generalizing way because women vary so much in their priorities. I will say that there was some interesting work done by a sociologist called Catherine Hakim on women's preferences, all other things being equal. It was done about 20 years ago. And she wanted to look at the question of, you know, if in an ideal world, what would your preference be for how you would want to balance work and home? You know, would you want to be at work full time? Would you want to be at home full time? Or would you want some kind of a mixture? And what she established is that on average, it breaks down about 60% of women want some mixture of the two. And of the rest, roughly 20% want to be stay at home mums. And the other 20% want to be professionally ambitious. And of the professionally ambitious subset, some proportion won't have children at all. But by far the majority of women would prefer some balance of work and home.
And to be clear, balance in this context, well, does it mean both all out, or it means, I guess, what does that mean? Tell me a little bit more about what balance means in the context of a study.
Generally speaking, it means working part-time and fairly flexibly. The majority of women would, with especially with young children, would prefer to work flexibly and ideally not full time.
Right, so balance means in contradistinction to having it all. It does not mean I'm a full career woman and I have children. It means taking at least some step back in professional ambition while raising young children.
It is not possible to have it all. It just isn't. I mean, I can, you know, speaking from my own personal experience, I mean, here I am in the United States. It's obviously possible. You know, I only have one child, which makes a difference. And she's no longer tiny, which makes a difference. But there are points where the contest is zero sum. You know, there are opportunities I have to decline because she needs me more at home. And there are times when she misses me terribly. For the most part, I have pretty much the holy grail in terms of mothering setups, in that I can work from home pretty much according to my own schedule. And if I need to take time off at short notice because my child needs me, I can. I mean, that's pretty much the optimum setup for somebody with children under 10. I would be willing to bet that the majority of mothers, if you offered them that setup, would bite your arm off. I mean, but this is obviously not something which is very easy to generalize about, because not all careers are identical. I mean, obviously, if you're an emergency room doctor, it's not going to work like that. But by the same token, it's not really a coincidence that women are very well represented in general practice, because women doctors are well represented in medical practice because it's something you can do part time that has predictable hours. So it's just much more easy to be a mother than if you were, say, an emergency room doctor. So yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to generalize about, but I would say on balance for women, a lot of the time, I think there are situations where we arrive at motherhood not realizing what it's going to be like. And I hear this quite a lot. You arrive, you know, you don't really know how you're going to feel. Yeah, but I mean, having kids is like going through the looking glass. You come out somewhere with a whole new repertoire of emotions. That, I mean, certainly this was my experience, and I hear it a lot from friends who have children, that they, you know, came out the other side of parenthood with just an entirely new palette of emotions that they didn't even realize existed. If you do that at the point where you're already fairly well established in a career, which is quite difficult to combine with that new palette of emotions and inclinations and desires, you know, it's a challenge. I mean, what do you do? What do you do at that point? And I think there's a non-trivial number of women who now find themselves in that position and feel very pulled in different directions as a result. You know, when younger women ask me, you know, do you have any advice for being, you know, planning for a world, a life where I can be a mum and also have a fulfilling career? And I say, you know, if you can optimize for a career that's fairly portable and that you can dial up or down at different points in your life, depending on the duty of the moment. So you can soft pedal it for a few years while your children are smaller, and then you can dial it back up again. You know, there are 1,001 different things that you could potentially do, which would fit those criteria, and some things which very obviously don't. And so when younger women ask my views on it, that tends to be the suggestion that I make. But again, you know, it's incredibly risky to try and make statements that are going to be applicable to everybody, because people's inclinations just vary. You know, and I equally know mothers who are perfectly happy to be working full time or more than full time, and who also devoted and loving and marvelous parents and make it work.
So what conclusion should we draw from the shortcomings of a feminist framework that you argue for, and the areas where the trade-off is particularly stark? If the sexual revolution has huge benefits that can lead to the commodification of women, if the fact that women can now have high-flying careers is an obvious positive, but it can lead to this intense conflict between a desire to be a caregiver to children and to persist in the career. Is this a call for simply an intellectual change in recognizing these trade-offs, or does something important follow from it for how we should think about the nature of sexual liberation in our society, the nature of female empowerment in the workplace, and so on?
I guess there's a few different resolutions that we could look at that question on. You know, at the very simplest level, it would be a good start simply to acknowledge that there are some trade-offs. That would be a very positive place to start. You know, and instead of saying, instead of implicitly suggesting to women, which happens a lot, that if you step back a little bit from, you know, sort of peak professionalism or whatever, that you're somehow a loser or letting the side down. And which I remember I felt distinctly when I got to, you know, my daughter got to about 1 year old, and my husband asked me if I wanted to go back to work. And And I realised that, I mean, I sucked at every career I ever attempted, from graduating up to accidentally becoming a writer. I was hopelessly unemployable by the time I had kids. And there was literally nothing that I could imagine doing that I would want, that motivated me enough to want to take me away from my baby at that point. Yeah, and I felt a bit ambivalent about saying that, because I felt like I was letting the side down, or, you know, somehow not being a good feminist, or not being a, does that, and then I thought, well, but this doesn't make sense. And furthermore, I also realised that the very fact that I had a choice to not go back to work, because we were financially in a position for me to have that choice, you know, was not evidence of oppression, as I'd always somehow sort of just implicitly believed as part of the ambient messaging that you receive from the culture. But in fact, it was an incredible privilege, and that there were a great many peers in my NCT group and whatever who were in a position where they had to go back to work, and they didn't particularly love their jobs, but it was either that or get the house repossessed. And that actually the question of freedom and choice and economic empowerment is a great deal, and what we may or may not have to sacrifice in terms of closeness to our children is a great deal more ambivalent than we might otherwise imagine. So I think if we were able and willing just to acknowledge some of those trade-offs, and to be able to talk openly about the fact that it's, you know, the being the girl boss isn't always the be-all and end-all, and actually it's okay to want to be a mum, and actually it's okay to say, no, I'm not going to take on this extra project because my child needs me this weekend, and it's okay to set those boundaries, and it's... And how dare you make me feel like a loser for having made those priorities and not these ones? I feel very protective of the mothers who do make those choices, and very very sort of defensive on behalf of every single stay at home mum who's ever had somebody instantly lose interest in them at a party when she says what she does all day. You know, and this happens a lot. Every stay at home mum can knows what it feels like when somebody says, so what do you do? And you say, oh, I'm a mum, and you can already see them looking over your shoulder to find somebody more interesting to talk to. It happens all the time, and I feel angry and protective on behalf of all of those mothers, because it's utterly priceless work, and it's somehow treated as infradig. It's treated as something that we can outsource. It's treated as something which can be done by subalterns and subordinates and third parties. Yeah. Often racialized minorities, and we can underpay those people because they're really, I mean, who cares? They're probably just a bit thick and useless anyway. And it's not true, because these are our children. And they, I mean, what is it? I struggle to think of anything that matters more. And I think, you know, this sort of ambient assumption that literally anything you could imagine doing is of greater value than being with your children, just grossly offensive. So it would be a good start to be able to speak to that a little bit more.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
So if we had more time than we do, we could quibble about whether your objections are to liberalism or to a certain kind of left-wing milieu. I think liberalism, rightly understood, should allow people choices, including the choice of whether they want to prioritize a career or whether they want to prioritize child rearing. But is this partially a jeremiad against a certain cultural set, against a set of assumptions in upper middle class metropolitan elites who say your worth is defined by your job? So if you're saying you're a stay-at-home mom, then there can't possibly be anything interesting about you at party, that you need to be the girl boss and so on. It's not clear to me that describes society as a whole, but it certainly seems to describe a sort of progressive-ish urban upper middle class. And I guess if that's the critique, then do they need to become more open to certain ideas that might be coded as small C conservative? Do they need to recognize that allowing people with choices is in fact a progressive value? How should we rethink culturally? And how can people speak to these concerns without coming off as reactionaries that just want to, you know, lock the woman back in the kitchen or whatever the kind of immediate objection from some members of that social set might be?
But I should add it this way. I don't see being a reactionary as something bad, but I don't think there's anything wrong with being a reactionary. But one of the structural problems that we have here, I mean, yes, absolutely, it's a critique of a certain social set. But the central problem, the structural problem, is that this is the set that has the mic. Almost absolutely overwhelmingly. I mean, just to illustrate, I was reading a great anthology of radical feminist writing from the 1990s, and in one of the pieces it recounts how this feminist group held a vote at their women's centre as about whether or not they were going to open a creche, and they voted against it. And the reason they voted against it was because all of the women who would have voted for it weren't able to turn up for the vote because they were looking after their kids. So there's a structural problem, or there has always been a structural problem with the representation of mothers in public political life, because we're busy and we can't show up to all of the late night hustings or whatever. And as a consequence of that, what incredibly commonly happens is that the women who do end up representing, as it were, the interests of all women in public life are the ones who didn't prioritize their families, because just obviously that's who has the time to show up. And then what happens downstream of that is that there's very little consideration given to the interests of those women who might have made different choices. So again and again, when you see women speaking in public about, you know, a feminist program for a feminist political program for when they're standing for election, what they'll generally be offering is more childcare. And what they're very much less likely to be offering, for example, might be transferable tax allowances or a childcare allowance which you could pay to extended family or form cooperatives with, or, you know, any one of 1,001 different ways that you might think more creatively about balancing work and family in order to meet the needs of the 60%. Invariably, what ends up happening is that what's framed as feminist within that context is the interests of the highly ambitious 20%. And the other, well, pretty much 80% of women go voiceless. One of the things which I think affords some hope is actually, for all that I'm very critical of the digital revolution in some respects, I think the internet, really the smartphone, has given mothers a voice in the feminist conversation again in a totally unprecedented way. In the sense that, I mean, you can scroll and you can tweet and you can participate in the discourse. You can participate to a significant extent in public life from your smartphone now in a way which gives mothers a voice in the conversation. And I think that's having a lot of really interesting downstream effects in the...
You don't have to go to the association meeting at 6 p.m. on a Tuesday when you actually want to be home with your child.
They'd had that women's centre vote about the creche, and those mums who were pushing the buggy around town to get their kid to sleep were able to vote remotely. Perhaps the vote would have gone differently. And this, at scale, this is having some very interesting effects on the women's movement as a whole, which, as you may or may not have noticed, is quite turbulent at the moment, with different groups of women quite intensely at odds about what does constitute women's interests. And I think one of the reasons that women are so... Well, once again, sort of grappling with these questions, is that voices have come into the conversation which had previously just been structurally excluded, and particularly those the voices of mothers. And to me, that's a real well, we could say I would call that progress, you know, on the terms which make sense to me.
You're skeptical about the extent of progress that we are able to make. What do you mean by that?
To be clear, I'm not an anti-feminist. I consider myself a feminist. You know, I care about women's interests, and I think those are often marginalised in relation to those of men. But I have questions about the liberal feminism which has become dominant, particularly in the last 50 years, which foregrounds sameness, foregrounds an aspiration to strict equality between the sexes and individual freedom over and above our relationships to one another. And though all of those things are underwritten by a commitment to medical means of managing the irreducible embodied asymmetries between the sexes.
So as a liberal...
So I have some questions about that, but the liberal feminism defined in those terms, more or less. And when I say I'm critical of progress, or I question how much progress we're able to make, it's more concrete, it's more fundamental than that. I don't believe progress is a thing. I think it's You know, the moment you set out to explain what you mean by progress, you have to define your terms. You know, we're progressing from worse to better on what metric? And the moment you've defined your metrics, you've assumed the truth of what you've set out to prove, which is to say you've begged the question. So I don't see how in any sort of absolute sense it's provable or disprovable or falsifiable, really, to claim that the world is getting better, or the total sum of human felicity or virtue or whatever is getting better in some absolute sense relative to, say, 1,000 years ago. I just don't see how you can prove that or disprove it. So I just don't believe. So to me, I see progress in as a sort of as a governing theology, if you like, for how we understand what's going on and what we should be trying to do. I see it as a belief rather than a fact, and it's not the framework that I choose to use. And really, I set out to write Feminism Against Progress as a way of trying to answer a question which had really bugged me for a long time since I realised I didn't believe in progress, or I lost my faith in progress theology, which is, is it possible to be a feminist if you don't believe in progress? Because it was a really difficult question to answer, because the story of, you know, progress as we understand it in the modern world and the history of feminism are very closely intertwined. And some of the most convincing pushback I might get on saying, well, I don't believe in progress, would be people saying to me, aha, yeah, but do you really want to go back to a world where women don't have the vote? Do you want to be the property of your husband? You know, we have made progress. There you are, you see. And I was thinking, well, hang on a minute. Is this actually true? You know, if so, do I have to either abandon my feminism or try and persuade myself again of this progress theology, which I don't really believe in? And the way I've ended up disaggregating the story of feminism and the story of progress is to rethink how we understand feminism, not as a story of moral improvement, of sort of directional moral ascent, if you like, from worse to better, in any sort of absolute sense, but as an aggregate set of responses to the transformations brought about in the modern world first through industrialization and subsequently through another tech transition, which is to say, birth control. And so that's my framework for thinking about what feminism is, the aggregate, women's aggregate responses to absolutely world-changing tech transitions. And I think when we think about it in those terms, it's possible to take it out of the more moralistic framework, if you like, of more good or less good, and some sort of directional arc of the moral universe, which is supposedly long but bending toward justice, and see it in a more grounded and contextual and anti-universalist way as a set of things which perhaps have some benefits, but which may also have come with some trade-offs, and where we can think critically and much more concretely about what those benefits and trade-offs are, who gains, who loses, and perhaps where we might need to rebalance how we're thinking about it in order to make space for some of those voices which have been marginalised.
Mary Harrington, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good Fight. Lots of listeners have been spreading the word about this show. If you too have been enjoying the podcast, please be like them. Rate the show on iTunes, tell your friends all about it, share it on Facebook or Twitter. And finally, please mail suggestions for great guests or comments about the show to goodfightpod@gmail.com. That's goodfightpod@gmail.com.
This recording carries a Creative Commons 4.0 international license. Thanks to Silent Partner for their song, Chess Pieces.